Breaking Bread is brought to you by North York Community House, an organization that builds strong, resilient, and inclusive communities in Northwest Toronto.
It's time for a shift. This is the shift. Big change, big things in the phase. Yeah.
My name is Sage Bankasing, and I'll be your host for this episode of Breaking Bread, Stories of Black Communities in Transition. Our limited podcast series seeks to take a deeper dive into redevelopment and uncover the truth about this phenomenon in the city of Toronto. Throughout this journey, we'll be speaking to residents and industry experts to shed light on the experiences of those living through these major transitions, providing further insight into the real consequences faced by urban redevelopment.
Self first, tired of the self hurt, so I put in that self work. Tired of the self hurt, so I put in that self work. Tired of the self hurt, so I put in that.
Yeah. Urban redevelopment is a very sensitive and nuanced topic, one that affects most metropolitan areas. Developers seek to restore older neighborhoods that aren't in great shape with the hopes of providing new housing to old residents, subsequently attracting new residents to the community and creating a lively neighborhood for individuals and families to thrive. Yet, despite all these perceived benefits, there are a number of issues with these redevelopment projects. On today's episode of Breaking Bread, Stories of Black Communities in Transition, we will be grounding some of the key concepts related to the redevelopment happening in Toronto. We'll explore the differences between revitalization and redevelopment, the drivers of such changes, and the effects these projects have on its residents. Today, we are joined by Cuddy Duncan, current Director of Strategic Initiatives of North York Community House, who will help us define these key ideas. We've also invited another guest, Denise Bishop Earle, who is a longtime resident and a community leader of Lawrence Heights, one of the largest revitalization projects in the city. Later on, Denise will discuss her experiences as a resident living through these changes. As previously mentioned, Cuddy Duncan is currently the Director of Strategic Initiatives at North York Community House, a nonprofit organization based in Toronto. He's worked in the sector for over 20 years in a variety of roles throughout the city. To start, Cuddy, could you tell us more about your experience in the industry?
Sure. Okay, so my name is Cuddy Duncan. I am right now with North York Community House. I'm the Director of Strategic Initiatives here. And in that work, what we're doing really at North York Community House, we're looking at a lot of different things. We're looking at community development and how we work in our communities and support residents to get engaged, get more active, take ownership of what's going on in their neighborhoods, right? And we're also looking at some strategic things for the organizations around economic development, where we're looking at digital transformation as an organization, how you kind of respond to this post-COVID world and what kind of your programs and hybrid programs just making things a bit more accessible for residents and that type of thing. So that's what I do at North York Community House. But I've been around for a bit. I guess I hope I'm not getting long in the tooth, so to speak. But I've been, I think, started doing this work really right out of high school. You know, I'm one of those typical young people where you take the Parks and Rec course and in leadership, and then you get involved with your summer programs and camps, and ever since, really just been working in community. And so it's been over 30 years now that I've been kind of working in community and doing this type of work all across the city of Toronto. And so I kind of, you know, I'm a lifer, so to speak, I guess, when it comes to this kind of work. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Cuddy, for the introduction. Your background and expertise in this industry and this sector makes you a perfect candidate for this podcast. So thank you for your time. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, I was just wondering if you could provide us with some information on NICH, just for those who aren't familiar with the organization.
Sure. Yes. No, well, NICH has been around for about 30 years now, and it started off as a community development initiative. I'm not sure if people recognize that it started with the North York area, up at the Bathurst and Lawrence area, really. Doing work around community development, helping newcomers, and had a small little office in the neighborhood and supporting newcomers as they come, kind of get more involved in their communities. And they kind of expanded and to do just a full multi-service organization now, right? Still heavily with the newcomer initiative, but touching on a lot of different things. And so that piece around community development, that theme of community development and commitment to community development has been there from the beginning. And so the work that we're doing in the communities right now always kind of touch on community development. When you look at our mission statement for the organization, we like to think of it as settle, thrive, and belong. And those is like a quick way to be able to understand what we're really about: settle, thrive, and belong.
That was amazing. Thank you so much for that, Cuddy. So, jumping right in, could you please start us off with defining urban redevelopment for us? I know for most of us living in the city of Toronto, we're very familiar with urban redevelopment, but just as a starting point for our conversation and also for this podcast series, could you please define urban redevelopment?
Sure. And again, I'm going to speak from a community development lens, like an individual that's kind of been committed to working from community first and not so much as an urban planner. I mean, I know there are hard urban planning definitions to some of these pieces, right? So sure, urban redevelopment. So because there's a difference between development, like urban development to me, and kind of redevelopment, right? And, and I think what we're kind of caught up in is maybe the redevelopment piece, where you're looking at making a change to what was currently there. And what we were most concerned about when we're making change, we're talking about urban, oftentimes it's dealing with the physical structures that are there in the neighborhood. So roads, parks, buildings, things that are available for the public. You know, what do those look like? How do they support the community that's there right now? And how do they support, you know, who may be there in the near future? And that's kind of redevelopment. You're looking at kind of what exists and how it's changing. And oftentimes what we want to do is make sure that that change is informed by those who are there and it supports those who are there. When the change doesn't support those who are currently in the neighborhood, who are, you know, living with those conditions, then we have a problem. Then we are having something that kind of leads to gentrification, in my view, right? And we could talk a bit more about that as we go along. But the urban redevelopment piece is what we're thinking about.
Thank you, Cuddy. That was very insightful and an amazing start to our conversation today. On the topic of redevelopment, Cuddy, could you please list some of the key drivers behind redevelopment? For example, I'm sure we're all familiar with the construction on Eglinton West. That is a great example of transit-led development. However, there are a lot more in the context of Toronto. So could you please tell us a little bit more about the drivers behind redevelopment?
Sure. I mean, overarching, maybe I'll just start with just some general pieces. Like it occurs in different ways. I mean, sometimes if you're living in a private community, like private, the building is privately owned. Sometimes what you see is that the landlords could either sell it or they want to maximize an opportunity. And they'll say, okay, here's an opportunity to move away from a rental model into a condo model where I could tear down what's currently there and build something that would give me more profit, and then I'll be able to exit that investment a little bit easier, right? And so sometimes it's a business move. Sometimes there are just open spaces. Again, it's developer. This is kind of like a developer-led looking for opportunities. Sometimes, you know, we're looking at massive retail spaces that are transitioning into housing, right? Whether it's affordable housing, oftentimes it's condos that are going up, right? And it's developing a community. What maybe makes it especially concerning for some residents who are in those communities when they see, like, you know, the mall being torn down and condos going up, right, is that, you know, it changes the composition of the neighborhood. But then you see the same type of thing where it's transit-led or it's something, it's about infrastructure, government infrastructure, major government infrastructure. So oftentimes what we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years, really maybe even 20 years in the city, when you think about what was going on with the St. Clair, is that transit plan, as a city is growing and we have to kind of develop a way to kind of get people to and from work and home and whatnot, that we have to kind of reconsider what our transit infrastructure looks like. And so there's been a big push to be able to make, to increase public transit and to be able to make, the commute easier for people to get to and from work, right? And for business to occur in the city. The point I guess I'm making around the transit is that transit, whether you're doing underground or above ground, could be very disruptive. And what it not just disruptive about the construction, what it means is that you might be changing how people are able to access that neighborhood or access that community. Probably say those are probably two of the big drivers. I know we sometimes we've been trying to push like the fact that people need affordable housing and and have that be something that pushes development as brand new affordable housing. We haven't really been very successful of doing really big, brand new kind of social housing that's going to have really large impact. We have smaller projects in the city that's kind of gotten off the ground, right? And they still impact communities to a certain extent. But as far as the really intensive affordable housing projects, not too many of those things have been able to get off the ground. And I know there's a lot of work right now by the federal government putting new money available so that we could get out of ground. I know the mayor that currently has been talking about how we're going to be able to get big affordable housing projects off the ground. And then once those things kind of getting up and going, you're going to see a definite kind of impact for communities and people up from different perspectives in those communities having concerns and making their concerns known, right? And you'll see different people pushing different things and whatnot, and I expect a lot of activity in those communities. And so I would say from my lens, just quickly, transportation is a big one, development, opportunities, private development opportunities, and then big, city concerns like affordable housing and whatnot is another big driver that comes to me.
All right, and last but certainly not least, Cuddy, in your experience working in this industry, I was wondering if you believe redevelopment and its drivers contribute to anti-Black racism, and if so, how do you believe it contributes to anti-Black racism?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to touch on that. To me, it's always the elephant in the room, so to speak, right? It's the thing that kind of concerns me the most, kind of pisses me off the most, to be honest, right? I mean, it's not just about the city of Toronto. This is what I try to what calms me down a little bit sometimes is that recognizing that anti-Black racism is not a city of Toronto thing. It is kind of an international thing. It's everywhere you go. Unfortunately, there is a piece around anti-Black racism. That's there, I find, right? Anti-Black racism, like we said, I think at its core, it's about for the redevelopment to be successful, you need to have people participating, right? And meaningful participation. So that means really having the opportunity for how those communities develop to reflect their concerns and issues. And I think, oftentimes what you're seeing is Black communities being either intentionally not being involved, right? So that means people not connecting, not reaching out appropriately to get the right people involved in some of these plans. And sometimes it's unintentional. Sometimes people just think that they either know the issues that are there with Black communities are, they don't value it the same way in a sense. And so you kind of overlook what people have to say, right, about those re redevelopment opportunities. And it leads to, the first one, when it's done intentionally, it really leads to gentrification. It's one of the, to me, the worst type of things that you're doing when you're intentionally trying to gentrify a neighborhood, when you're intentionally trying to leave people out, right? To me, it's really kind of heat at its worst, right? And when it's unintentional, then it's really, again, it's people just not, there's a professionalism that we have to bring to this business and a commitment we have to make to the work that we do. And we need to be able to see all key stakeholders around who are involved in urban development, ensuring that they understand the communities that are there and they do their due diligence to make sure that people are who need to be there are at the table. And that's the only way we get to a city that could respond to all the needs and concerns that we have that could really maximize the opportunities that that everyone kind of brings to the table, right? And we are a better city when everyone is really to be able to be an equal actor there. So yes, I do think anti-Black racism plays a strong role, and I'm hoping as like you do more interviews and you talk with more people, you'll be able to bring to life how it kind of plays out a bit more in certain communities.
And that wraps our interview today. Thank you so much, Cuddy, for taking the time to have this conversation with me. You definitely provided some key insights that are very important to this podcast. So thank you so much for your time.
Time has switched. We owning up to self-hurt. We learned our lessons quick. We grown and doing self-work. It's a rebirth. We tapped in and we turned on and we tuned in to a new song. It's been too long. The self-hate is long gone. It's a new dawn and a new wave and a new age. New rules that we remade. Old rules need to cremate and to create and to be brave. I told you.
Denise Bishop Earl is a longtime resident of Lawrence Heights. Having lived there for nearly 40 years and raising her family in the community, she has a lot to say about the revitalization happening and how it has affected herself and her neighborhood as a whole. Hi, Denise, and thank you for joining us today. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself, your experience with the revitalization happening, and your involvement in it so far?
Hello, my name is Denise Bishop Earl, and I have been living in Lawrence Heights for about 38 years. When my oldest daughter was 2 months, I moved here. On May 14th of 1984. My experience with revitalization has been a mixed bag. I remember Dominic approaching me, Dominic Greasy, who was our community development officer for TCH or whatever they called them back then. They keep changing the name. He approached me and asked me if I would be an animator. At the time I was like, meh. I don't really know if I really want to be, because I just felt that revitalization for me was like what's going on in other places and spaces. Like in the United States, revitalization was the taking over of many Black communities. And so I was really like, oh, I don't really know if I really want to be a part of this. But I also felt strong about the whole idea of trying to protect Lawrence Heights and trying to make sure that we got as much out of revitalization as we possibly could have. And so as an animator, I made sure that I was involved as much as possible in creating as much change and really challenging a lot of the ideals and the structures that were presented to us, and making sure that residents of Lawrence Heights were involved as much as we could possibly get them involved. In fact, we did a lot of change making, and there was from what I understand, different countries like South Africa and different parts of the United States actually came here, and it's through some of our James walks to see and understand how revitalization was being changed by the activism of the Lawrence Heights residents. And there was a lot of us really making real strong changes, and they were looking at our model and really studying it to see what they could do in their countries as well.
Would you say that the animator program has been beneficial for residents in the Lawrence Heights community?
I think it was beneficial for the residents, because we ended up with, 10 priorities that we put down that were part of the social development plan, a plan which sort of identified different areas in the community. I mean, different areas that needed to be focused on in terms of supporting the transition of people of Lawrence Heights into a new community, as well as inviting new people in. So you have the current residents and the residents who are considered new residents. It sort of focused on how we could live and work together. It's kind of that build back better together ideal, but I think that the animator program worked as long as they allowed it to work, because what happened essentially was, when we were at our height of creating change as residents and as animators, they stopped the program. And for 2 years, there was no program, and there was no communication to the residents, any clear communication. And when we did have communication about what was happening with revitalization, it came very late. And so for 2 years, there was no voice in terms of what changes were happening with the revitalization. And then they came up with this whole idea of ambassadors. Now, I don't know how successful that program has been, but I've noticed there's been a high level of turnover, because the ambassadors that started are not the ambassadors that are there now. So, from what I understand is they have no voice. When we were animators, we were part of all the changes, whether it was picking the development partner or defining the names of the different streets in all the communities, or even looking at where the parks could be, how many trees could be in those spaces. You know, what does the inside of each unit look like, and how do we support residents who were physically challenged or had different challenges, and how do we identify what those things were? We were active in every element of it until they decided we weren't.
Thank you, Denise. I'm wondering, at what point or stage in the Lawrence Heights revitalization did they decide to discontinue the animator program?
I think when we start challenging some of the things that they did, and that would have been just before they start demolishing the first building. And I think part of it was we had created a petition. And in this petition, we were highlighted different areas that we as residents wanted addressed. I can't remember what those it was because it's been such a long time, but it was like addressing employment opportunities, addressing, you know, different things that were happening in the community at the time, and feeling that they needed to really look at all these different things that were going on and honor what they had originally said about, you know, creating a space that was going to support our needs as well as a new community, the current resident, as well as the residents who were coming in. And I think that they slowly were just pushing the whole concept of the social development plan in the background. And when we're looking at zero displacement and all these other things that we were supporting with our 10 priorities, and even the whole ideal of home ownership for residents, it was becoming less and less seen as something that was going to be tangible. And it slowly, all the things that we had fought for were just seemed to be crumbling and dissipating and floating away. And it was like, okay, what is this? And we were slowly pushed out of the tables. Meetings were happening and we weren't being invited to those tables. And then one day we weren't invited to tables anymore. There was just, they didn't even close the animator program. They didn't even say, thank you very much. We appreciate all the work, hard work you did for the past, how many years, since 2008 till 2014, 2015, 2016, 2018, whatever it was. I can't even remember anymore. It just stopped. And they didn't communicate with us. Only when they wanted to ask us or something, or if they were trying to extract certain information from us. But it just stopped.
And since then, has your involvement with the Revite changed or evolved since you stopped being an animator?
Yes, it has changed. I think we're part of the Lawrence Heights Coalition, the Lawrence Heights Revite Coalition now. I haven't really been invited to any of the revitalization meetings. I know they happened. And a lot of times what happens is when I hear about revitalization meetings, it's too late. It's like either the day of and I can't make that time, or I find a flyer sitting on the ground in my backyard. It's like, okay. And so with the coalition, I think we have a better focus on what we as residents want to do and how we control the narrative and how we want to be seen and heard in those spaces, and actually have not just a voice at the tables, but at the head tables. And so working with other residents like Trudy Ann and Miss Beverly and Kumsa and all these other people who are supporting moving a lot of our ideals and our needs and the things that we see as important forward. I think that that's a better thing. It's just like having a tenant association. It's better to have an association that's separate from the space you want to, of the organization you want to change, than being a part of it, because sometimes they control the agenda. And so by being separate, then we control the agenda and what we think is important in that space.
As a longtime community resident and leader, in your experience, what have been some of the common feelings felt by residents towards the revitalization happening in Lawrence Heights?
In the past, since even before COVID happened, there has been so much lack of communication about revitalization. And because we don't have any real residents who speak for the community at these tables, I think it's about, you know, if you don't know what's happening, there's a sense of fear and isolation. And when you have fear and isolation, then you have anger. because you feel like you're being disrespected and disregarded. And not understanding the impact. I don't think the people who are part of developing and moving forward revitalization, the management team, the developer partners, TCH, and all those people who are involved, including the city, I don't think they really are considering the impact it has on the mental health of residents. And when you have mental health issues, there's another layer of fear, frustration, anger, trauma, and all those things create anger. And so I think that it's about recognizing that we're stakeholders in this process. We're just not clients, in a sense of, okay, we're doing this for you and you should be thankful and grateful. When I even look at the first building, it's like the whole idea was to build back better and together, but they're still separate. And so we're just separate, but closer. And so that sense of feeling that you are being, your needs are being addressed, I think it's becoming more toxic in the sense that, you know, you have this us and them ideology where you have the new residents having all these great amenities. And when you look at the other part of the building that's lower and smaller, there are no amenities. And even having access to community spaces is actually at a minimal, if not at all. I can't really speak to that, but from what I'm hearing, even in the new buildings, there is no access to the amenities that were there, and there's very limited amenities at that. So how do you really feel good about revitalization when you're actually being stigmatized even more? And, you know, and that us and them challenge that was there, that isolation that we had because we were boxed in as a community, is still there. And it's the proximity is even closer. And it's reminding our children every day that you're not as important as those people over there in the higher part of the building. They have all that stuff. But because you're poor, you're not going to get that stuff. It's not for you. And so creating that sense of othering, continuing, but at a closer proximity, makes people even more upset.
Let's switch gears a bit. From a developer's point of view, if you had a proper seat at the table and you knew your ideas would be implemented, what would you want to change about the revitalization processes or procedures?
The first thing I would look at is, I think, the demographics. Because when we look at demographics, we think of the mixed income. And to really study what is the best way to support the integration of mixed income families and mixed income communities, and to create a space that is not only has good amenities for all and provides good employment for all, but also creates a safe space for everyone. Because the way we're creating these spaces right now, I don't think residents feel safe in those spaces. So how are we going to create a community that is safe for everyone? Because one of the issues they were having is good housing. You may be giving them good housing, but the other issue that we had in Lawrence Heights was having safe space, because of the level of community-based violence. How does revitalization address that piece? I'm not sure if they're really addressing that piece, or if that's like something that they really didn't consider, like fully looking at the historical roots of violence in communities and what was the impact of it? Why did it happen in the first place? Just building new buildings is not going to change that aspect until you get to the root of the problem. So I think I would be more consider, how do we create a safe space for everybody, current residents especially, but also for those who are moving in?
And my last question to you, Denise, is if you could talk to those in charge of the Lawrence Heights Revite, what would your message be?
Nothing for us, without us, is about us. That would be my message. Because if you say you are building a community to support, I will say, you use the word emancipating the current residents from these buildings that are dilapidated and moldy and you know, mouse ridden and cockroach ridden and whatever, and building a space that is safe from community-based violence and a space where there are more amenities and more opportunities for employment and for personal development in terms of access to recreation centers that offer far more than our present recreation center, or other amenities that allow us to gather together in safe spaces and to enjoy each other's company. If you're building that kind of space, if you think that not having those voices at those tables to have conversations around what's working right now, what's not working, and where do we need to make changes, because there needs to be safeguards that continue to happen throughout the revitalization. If something's not working, we need to say, hey, hobo, and change that thing. Making change is hard, it takes time. And if you don't do it right, then we're gonna be doing this again in another 50, 60, 70 years because we didn't do it right the first time. So it's about nothing about us without us is for us.
And that concludes our episode for today. Thank you so much for everyone who joined us. This is the first episode of Breaking Bread, Stories of Black Communities in Transition. Join us next week as we begin to explore the impacts of redevelopment on Black communities.
This is the shift. Big change, big things in the phase. Yeah, big change, big things in the phase. Yeah, big change, big things in the phase. Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by North York Community House. North York Community House builds strong, resilient, and inclusive communities in Northwest Toronto. We help children, youth, parents, and seniors become active, engaged citizens who lead positive change in their neighborhoods. Find us at nych.ca.